All righty. Well, I will go around and say hello to everybody who's here, starting with Ellen. And Ellen, it always confuses Shoketsu, whose birth name is Ellen. When I say Ellen, she probably goes, oh, wait. Alice. Bob K. Simone. Phil. Aaron. Mark. Amelia. Jim. Ruby. Marv. Shintai. Paulette. Karen. Elvin. Mary. Shoketsu. Brian. Joan. Bob O. John. Soon. Linda. Sarah. Sabrina. And Sandy. All right, good group today. Hi. Can't think of anything in particular I should announce. Can anybody think of anything or have any questions about what's coming up? All right. I guess if anybody's curious, we are, who knows when we'll be able to meet in person again. The timeline looks like probably not before July. That would be a very optimistic start time, I think, when hopefully everybody who's willing to be vaccinated will be vaccinated and cases will fall and hospitalizations will fall and all that kind of stuff. So that probably be the soonest, and we haven't thought that much about exactly how we go about that, but we do know that we are committed to providing ample online opportunities for those of you who are at a remove, and exactly how we're going to do that and have a Sangha that's partly local and partly online. And I would imagine that there's going to be people who are local and could theoretically come who still are going to be happy to participate online sometimes rather than make a commute or stuff like that. So chances are we're going to do some kind of mix of hybrid events. Sundays will probably be hybrid events where we're in the Zendo. We have an elaborate setup that Bob K is going to help us with. We'll go study how they do it at Dharma Rain, where there's a camera and there's a laptop and a big screen and microphones and speakers and all that kind of stuff, so that people can, participate in what's happening in the Zendo online. And also probably some online only stuff, because that always has just a little bit different feel than something that you're kind of like witnessing, if you're online, you don't feel quite like you're fully participating. And then probably a few things that are only in person as well, so that people can come to the Zendo and not have technology present. So anyway, we're giving thought to that. I think it'll be a little bit of a, I've been thinking of giving some kind of Dharma talk about this. It'll be a little bit of a transition, I think, when we go back and our Sangha will have changed, whether we like it or not. But then again, so we say in Buddhism, change is the only constant. So how do we make that shift and, have the local people not feel like they've lost their Sangha somehow? Or, and if you have any, concerns or questions or ideas, please feel free to share them with me, or I'm sure we'll have some opportunities. We often have, Sangha meetings and stuff on various topics for discussing this kind of thing as well. So stay tuned for that. Any questions or comments before I get started.
I have a question
Yeah.
about the Tuesday evening like class. Is that like free to anyone to attend?
Yep, just like this. So it's the same Zoom, same password, and yeah, just a little bit different schedule. And Ruby, I can't forget, where are you located?
I'm in Bellingham, Washington.
Oh, cool. Same time zone then, because sometimes the Tuesday classes are a little late for people, but okay. So today's talk is on the ceremony of Vaisak, which we just did today. So this is the festival of the Buddha's birth, and it happens early spring, early April, early May, the world over in Buddhist communities of all different types. So you'll see behind me the altar is different than it usually is. And I'll actually take the camera and show you close up what it looks like. So when we're in the Zendo, we have, you know, we have this statue, which is the statue of the baby Buddha. And he's standing in a bowl, and there's tea in the bowl, and there's a little ladle. And we build a whole bower of flowers. So there's a whole little structure, and people bring tons of flowers, and we decorate it all. So he's completely like covered and encased in flowers. And then during the ceremony, everyone has a chance to go up and, you know, bow to the statue and take the ladle and pour some tea over the Buddha's head. And it's very sweet. And I'll explain more in a little bit, but I just wanted to show you. And in case when you were doing the ceremony, you missed that or something, I'll pour some tea over his head too. All right, so let me see. It's a little awkward. So there's the Buddha surrounded by flowers, and there's his the bowl and a little ladle. And then everybody comes up and pours tea over his head. And this is from the story that sweet tea rained down from the sky when he was born, along with showers of flower blossoms. So, during the ceremony, we sing some songs and do some chants. And generally speaking, you know, almost all of our ceremonies involve people processing up and down the rows of cushions in such a way that everybody ends up passing an altar that's set up particularly for the ceremony, and then being able to make some kind of offering at that altar. And at Dharma Rain, where Shintai and I and So-on trained, you know, it's a bigger sangha, and they had more staff and people and kids. So this was a really big day for the kids. So we always had the kids come over for the ceremony, and, you know, the adults would help the little kids, like pour the little, you know, ladle of tea over the Buddha and bring flowers. So the kids would always be the ones that decorated the bower. And then afterwards, there was always a birthday cake for the Buddha, and the youngest kid would blow out the candles. And then someone, in most years, someone had built a pinata of a white six-tusked elephant, which is, according to the mythology, that's how the Buddha's mother was impregnated, was a elephant. Like, she dreamt that an elephant entered her side, and then she became pregnant with the Buddha. So we had the pinata and had the excitement of, you know, kids with sticks trying to break it open. So it was a very joyous day. So I want to say something about the supernatural aspects of this story, which, you know, I read at the beginning of the ceremony, and I realized some of you weren't there, you know, that she was impregnated by an elephant in a dream. She had no pain. The Buddha wasn't born in the normal way. He just emerged from her side, fully conscious, and that he immediately stood up and took 7 steps. And then he did this, the symbol, the, you know, which you can see in the statue, he pointed to the heaven and he pointed to the earth. And he said, you know, as this birth is a Buddha's birth, it is my last birth. Just in this one birth, I shall save all. And then, you know, flowers rained down from the sky and fierce beings were momentarily at peace and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So, you know, I view all of this as mythology, but that means it's not dismissive in the sense that I don't believe this stuff really happened. But it's significant anyway, as a myth that we have passed down. And so I'm just going to share Joseph Campbell's view on myth. So it says, as a strong believer in the psychic unity of mankind and its poetic expression through mythology, Campbell made use of the concept to express the idea that the whole of the human race can be seen as engaged in the effort of making the world transparent to transcendence by showing that underneath the world of phenomena lies an eternal source which is constantly pouring its energies into this world of time, suffering, and ultimately death. To achieve this task, one needs to speak about things that existed before and beyond words, a seemingly impossible task, a solution which lies in the metaphors found in myths. These metaphors are statements that point beyond themselves into the transcendent. So we're celebrating the birth of Shakyamuni Buddha. Did a man named Siddhartha Gautama, later Shakyamuni Buddha, ever even exist? Did he single-handedly discover and teach all the essential parts of Buddhism? Maybe. But does it really matter? Whether one person created and shared Buddhism, or a whole bunch of people did, a whole bunch of unnamed people, this was discovered and created by human beings, and they passed it to us. So ceremonies can help us access our emotions. And we have lots of examples of this in our culture as well, right? There's reasons we get together for funerals and, you know, do sentimental things and have music and stuff like that so that we can access emotions that are otherwise might be difficult to do. So what emotions, what things are we trying to access with our Vaisak ceremony? Is it adoration for Shakyamuni? I would say, you know, maybe, but it's not the kind of like hero worship or, you know, awe for a founder that is meant to keep you in line. So it's not a matter of us thinking, oh, Shakyamuni's so great, I'm not going to, you know, question anything he says or anything like that. Like, I'll just toe the line because he's so amazing. That's not the kind of devotion or awe or gratitude that we're looking for here. So you think about it, let's assume that Siddhartha Gautama existed, that he had spiritual questions arise that he refused to let go of, even though the people around him were like, don't think about that, just enjoy yourself. He persisted, he struggled, he searched, he tried different paths. They didn't answer his question. He persisted anyway and refused to be waylaid by doubt. And he discovered, he awakened to something. And then, even though he doubted that anybody would understand what it was he awakened to, he tried teaching it to people and then did that for the rest of his life. So I guess think about what this has made possible in your own life. What have you learned from your exposure to Buddhism and teachings and practices? What have you discovered, escaped, transcended, accepted because of the Buddhist teachings and practices? We can't know what would have happened on a different trajectory, right? Like if I'd never encountered Buddhism, I don't know, maybe you would have encountered something else. Maybe you would have had some of these realizations yourself. Maybe you just through age and maturity, you would have realized some things. So you can't really second guess that. But, you know, never having encountered Zen meditation, never having encountered mindfulness, the idea of mindfulness, our way of working with precepts and paramitas, our emphasis on Sangha. So for myself, I feel like my encounter with Zen, Buddhism, if you will, but in particular, Zen is what that's what made it all accessible to me personally. I feel like it gave me my life. I was 24 when I first, I mean, I've had heard about Buddhism before, and, you know, some world religions class in high school or something, but I hadn't really registered. So I was 24 when I really became curious about it. And I was amazingly neurotic and full of despair, despite the fact that my life was, you know, from outward appearances, looked fine and fortunate and comfortable. But life seemed very pointless and meaningless. It was like going from one kind of temporary distraction where I could, you know, smile and cope and enjoy, but then in between it just go flat again. And I didn't see, and I saw myself falling into dysfunctional behaviors that I didn't know how to break out of. This isn't how I wanted to be living. This isn't who I wanted to be, but I didn't seem to be any option. I just watched myself repeat these things. And my encounter with, you know, they're very simple concepts in a way, but just, hey, how about you just, you know, sit down and be with yourself, you know, quietly for a while. How about that? How about you wash the dishes without just trying to get them done? How about you be present for your life? To me, this was enormously radical stuff that completely shifted my entire life. And somehow I just turning around, you know, turning that light and shining it inward started shifting things. I felt like I had more choice. I had more, as I enacted my dysfunctional patterns, there came a point where I could actually catch myself before I went down a particular road and think, how else could I respond? Maybe there's something else I can do here. And I could try it. And things started to work better. And my ultimate testimonial was I always tried to stop biting my nails. And I stopped biting my nails. I mean, that's not something that you can kind of willfully do. It was a profound change. And, you know, the path certainly didn't end there. That was my honeymoon with Buddhism. Then I went through difficult times as well. But coming around to a point of joy and peace and self-sufficiency and confidence in the practice that anything that I encounter in this life, no matter how devastating, no matter how horrible, I will have practice and I will do my best. And that is just that is what I rest in. And that is, yeah, it gave me, you know, that kind of lack of taste for life that I had. Like everything was kind of bleak and meaningless. Gradually, I don't know, what do you say, dissipated, or I overcame, or however you want to phrase it. And, you know, it was quite a while. But I remember at some point just thinking, huh, well, wonder what I'm going to do with my life. Because now it looked like there were lots of possibilities. So that kind of, that, you know, taking you from a point of bleakness where you even think at times about ending it all, to a stable, confident joy. I mean, geez. And, you know, presumably if Shakyamuni Buddha or some beings hadn't formulated this path and passed it on, I would have been lost. So I had gratitude to my teacher, definitely, and all the teachers before. So this is why we, if you've participated in our morning chanting, our regular morning service has an ancestral lineage, which frankly can be pretty boring, long, and it's just name after name, and okay. But that is why we do it, is like this act of acknowledgement and gratitude that we regularly do. And we list every name from Shakyamuni Buddha all the way down to the last teacher in our lineage who has already passed away. So all of them kept the practice alive and passed it down. Another example of just profound gratitude that I feel, for one thing, you know, so we alternate between chanting the traditional line of Dharma ancestors from Shakyamuni Buddha. And there's a few places where that lineage gets a little mythological, in the sense that that teacher didn't necessarily even meet that student or whatever. But most of the way, it really is like this teacher, and then they had that student, and that student became a teacher, and they taught the next person. And this is how they passed it on. So we have a line of women Dharma ancestors that we alternate and we chant. And it's not a lineage in the traditional sense, in that most of the, I mean, the vast majority of time, women were lucky to be able to practice at all, let alone establish a teaching lineage. So there just is no women's lineage, you know, sadly. But this is a list of women who, that's why I have it phrased as they kept the practice alive throughout time. In particular, they kept the practice alive for women in their various ways. And I personally, I feel more deeply moved when I chant that line than I do the other one, because half the guys in that line probably wouldn't even have taken me as a student. Whereas the women, you know, they had a tough time and they kept it alive. Another really moment of this, this experience of gratitude that, you know, without some particular being, I would not be who I am. I would not have the life that I have. I experienced this with a traditional ceremony that only women do, only particularly ordained women do in Japan. And it may extend beyond Japan, but this is in Japan. And it's called the Ananda ceremony, or Ananshiki. And it's a ceremony in gratitude to Ananda and Mahaprajapati. So if you recall, the Buddha didn't want to ordain women because it's figured it would just cause too much problem. he said women were perfectly capable of practice and enlightenment. But, you know, just, I mean, back then I could see, you know, like now you're opening a whole can of worms, and now people are going to be saying you're breaking up families, and, you know, so he just didn't want to go there. So he refused. But Ananda, one of his main students, insisted and said, well, so you said women were perfectly capable, right? And the Buddha says, yes. He's like, huh, Well then, and he kept hounding the Buddha until the Buddha was like, okay, fine. So then he ordained the women. And so Ananda was speaking on behalf of Mahaprajapati and all the women who basically were already living like nuns and showed up and kept following the Buddha around until he would ordain them. And I just remember participating in this beautiful ceremony, which is it's like no men ever get to like participate or witness in the ceremony, and just participating and then just realizing, having this sense, like it was so important to me and it still is, that I had the opportunity to practice as an ordained person, to go into monastic practice, to carry those vows, and like these people's compassion made it possible. And I just remember the first time that I did that ceremony, I just had tears streaming down my face of just gratitude. And I wouldn't, without the ceremony, I don't think I ever would have accessed that kind of feeling. So you think about for yourself, you know, even beyond the Dharma, what other human beings, you know, without whom you would not have the life that you do? Your parents, friends, say for many people, the creator of AA and all the people who kept that tradition alive. This is kind of an interesting example, but how about Alexander Fleming, who spent many years tirelessly researching antibacterial substances and finally discovered penicillin? There's probably quite a few of us who wouldn't even be here today without that. And certainly we'd have loved ones that wouldn't be here today, or we would not be living the healthy lives that we are. So just, you know, these people, real people, and their endeavors and their efforts, we owe almost everything to. So, but part of our special respect and awe for Shakyamuni is the idea that he discovered these basic truths and this path more or less on his own. So that's why he gets like special billing, right? I'm just a teacher who learned it all and, you know, hopefully have a little skill in explaining it and sharing it and, you know, witnessing to it, right? But I didn't make it up. Whereas, you know, somebody originally, like there's many places in practice where without the coaxing of the teachings or the teacher or fellow practitioners, you probably are going to be taking steps or doing things that you wouldn't otherwise do. I mean, sit still on a cushion and do nothing. Okay. Like why would you do that? Why would that help? Why would, if something arises in your life that is really troubling, internally or externally, you know, the common sense says, okay, well, you know, try to make it end or distract yourself from it or something. But Buddhism says, go closer to it. Feel it. Accept it. Let it be. Let your relationship to it shift. I don't know that I would have come up with that myself. Certainly no, I don't think any of us would have thought, well, let's sit for 7 days straight for 8 hours a day. That sounds like a good idea. Somebody else said, no, you should really try this. You know, who would have thought that we are encouraged to see ourselves as intimately dependent on Sangha, on other people. And yet there's a way that we are looking for a way of being that does not rely on anyone. How can they both be true? Right? But then the practice is saying, yes, they can both be true. So explore that. What about the emphasis on spiritual rewards that mean access to joy and peace no matter what happens in our lives? That was perhaps the most radical discovery and teaching of the Buddha. was that no matter what happens, you know, your experience of your life is largely dependent on the state of your own mind. So that gives you back some, I don't know about control, but influence over your life. So in terms of, you know, summoning gratitude for teachers, for people whose innovation or generosity has allowed us to have the lives that we have, you know, what is the good of cultivating gratitude? I don't think it really has anything to do with making sure that those teachers or those people get kudos. That's not really, you know, what it's about. I mean, we may express gratitude, we may offer support or offerings or something, and that's great, but that's not really the primary thing. It's really the state of our own mind and heart, the profound recognition of interdependence. You know, I have a sense of myself, but who would I be without all of these people who taught me and supported me and guided me? A celebration, appreciation, and wonder at what we have or are. You know, that we even just turn to us, wow, look at this, you know, in Vaisak, look at this tradition that we have, look at this Sangha that we have. A sense of abundance instead of lack, which leads to generosity naturally. And perhaps also a willingness to pay it forward. We recognize that we've received things, and therefore we either help pass them on, help make them accessible to other people, and or maybe we have our own gifts that we can give. So I will leave it there. I don't know. We still have some time. So how about if we spent 10 minutes in breakout rooms discussing who are some human beings, past or present, whether you knew them or not, to whom you feel deep, deep gratitude? Teachers, parents, friends, historical figures, whatever. Get us in the gratitude celebratory mode, and then we'll come back and share a little and have some questions. So I will invite you. Bob, it looks like you just have to go ahead and join a room as host. You don't get assigned. Maybe room five only has three people in it. Well, four people. I'll join room four. All right. Anybody, here's something cool in your room that you want to share. I want to note that we talked a little bit about non-human teachers. And yeah. Just go ahead and either unmute yourself or raise your hand electronically. That's been working well. questions are welcome too. Bob.
I wanted to reflect on one of my members in my breakout group, the other Bob. He pointed out that he can have a teacher of the moment. And I thought that was very special because there, you know, there are teachers of long term, you know, years and years and years. And then there's the teacher that teaches you something right that second. And I thought that was really valuable.
So I missed the question due to an audio glitch. Could you repeat it?
We were just reflecting back on what we heard in our breakout rooms, and also, you know, move into questions and comments just about Vaishak and teachers and gratitude. Brian.
We agreed that we had very long rosters of teachers to whom we owe deep gratitude. But one thing that was surprisingly common was the lesson of how precious, how much worth the sort of mentee had as a consequence of being in the relationship. So it might have been something slight. It might have been a teaching of the moment, or it might have been a deeper relationship. But that one of the things we took away from it was something adding to a conviction that we were people who mattered, people to take seriously, that we ought to take ourselves seriously, that we were precious. And that was, I didn't enter the conversation anticipating that, so I was very grateful for it.
That's really cool. Amelia.
Well, along the lines of what I was in Brian's group, and it was just so wonderful and so revealing what people had to share about, you know, the deeply personal effect that some people have had on your lives. And, you know, it's not necessarily we thought about historical personages, but really it all came down for us to people that affected our lives personally. And at the very end, I just sort of really had this moment of realizing how important it is to let those people know how grateful we are. While they're still here with us, and how much it means to them. There's teachers who say that, you know, their third grade students came back and thanked them 20 years down the line, and how it just meant everything to them. And I think of that. I think of all the people that I really am so grateful for in their lives. And I think it's a real practice to let them know that gratitude and bless them. So, yeah.
Thank you. So, On?
Yeah, somebody in our group mentioned like people we can't even ever know who they are, and talked about like recipes and foods and whoever came up with this food and whoever thought to cook this, you know, and there's so many things in our life that we can't even possibly know, like who invented the wheel, who invented bread, you know, we can't know, but we can still have this intangible feeling of gratitude toward.
I just had the very strange image of taking the ladle full of tea and pouring it over my computer monitor in gratitude for all the people who made Zoom possible, you know, countless people.
Domi, I just wanted to say I'm grateful for you.
I've been to a few of these Vesak ceremonies, and I wondered, how could you ever say anything to embellish such a simple thing? And just all your sharing of how you progressed, and just your explanation of the mythology, and just, you made it such a fantastic lesson again. I just don't know how you managed to do that, but I loved it. I did want to ask, is it a coincidence that Easter is today?
Kind of. I mean, I suspect that Easter kind of randomly showed up this time of year, and Vesak randomly showed up this time of year for similar reasons. You know, it's spring, there's flowers, it's new birth. So, you know, I think both dates are kind of arbitrary. This time, actually, it's ideal in our society not to make Vesak land on Easter if you want people with kids to show up for your ceremony, because, you know, then you're competing with Easter. So if we'd actually been in person, I might have scheduled it a little differently. But it's kind of sweet. You know, for many of us, like, we're not celebrating Easter, so we celebrate Vesak instead. It's kind of sweet. And there was candy involved when the kids were at their piñata and stuff. So it was kind of a Marv.
A little bit of background. One of the reasons for the coincidence, not just time of year, but Vesak is a lunar month. And the Sikh here in Vancouver celebrate Vesak because it's a ceremony in their religion as well. Huh. It's celebrated in the month of Vesak. But Easter is also timed according to Jewish Pesach, which is regulated by lunar months.
Ah.
So there you go.
Cool. Runs deep.
Thank you, Marv.
Paulette.
I just want to say I love that baby Buddha statue. I just absolutely adore it. It's so cute. And it only comes out once a year.
You know, I was just thinking today, I think I've always been drawn to, I mean, even though I'm a really skeptical person, and I've never, like, well, I don't know about never, but for the most part, I've never believed in God. I've never believed in the supernatural, whatever. Like, I've always really, I think, loved ceremony and ritual objects and things like that. So one of the things that I really loved when I was growing up was Mr. Rogers, like, what is it? Like the place of imagination or something. He sends the trolley through the tunnel, and then you come out into the place of imagination, and then there's all these little like puppets and objects and scenes, and they kind of, you know, unlock something. So that's why, you know, at the Zen Center we have, you know, there's a little shelf, and there's the Nahan statue, right? And there's the Vesak statue, and there's the all these different little objects that we bring out to create a certain kind of atmosphere or scene. And I have to say, like, I think ceremony and ritual is really good for somebody like me who is really intellectual and skeptical and not very devotional, because it just taps something that usually I'm kind of holding at bay. And I have to say, every time, you know, especially when you're doing it with other people, and you, it's your turn in front of the Vesak altar, and you bow, and you take the little ladle and you pour. I mean, there's just, I'm always kind of close to tears just because it's just so sweet. And it's just accessing that gratitude and that amazement and wonder that we've been touching on today. And it just, that little gesture, that little physical gesture opens it up. It's so sweet.
I suppose as part of a parting shot, this is also the time that when, like the other day, we drove to my sister-in-law's for lunch, everybody's been vaccinated. It was so wonderful. But along the freeway from Portland to Eugene are the lambs that are being born. And if, when I go to the farm store, there are the chicks and the turkeys and the pheasants that are babies and are have just hatched, and people are taking them home to do their birds. And it does add a flavor of the beginnings, the birth, that piece of it. And it's a favorite time for me, this lambs jumping around in the fields.
Yeah. Oh, well, thank you all. Close with our dedication. Abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water. The mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas throughout space and time. All honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas. Wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita. And I should say that I feel grateful for Roshi Jiu Kennett, who composed that beautiful offertory at the end of the Vesak ceremony and a lot of our other chants that we sing. She inserted her Church of England musicality into Zen. So you wouldn't encounter that in Japan or pretty much any other lineage. The offertory you would, though. It's probably close to word for word what would be chanted in Japan, but it wouldn't be sung like that. Well, have a good rest of your day. Thank you all.
Thank you, Domyo.
Thank you, Domyo. Thank you, everybody. Bye.
Bye. Thank you, everybody. Bye-bye.
Thank you, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye.